I could call it Behind the Bottle, if you wanted to take it that way. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Dallas in May 6, 44. And fortunately, I haven't had any return of the symptoms of this illness, which would be drinking. And I might say probably, basically, I had exhausted every resource to get well before I came into AA. And I don't believe nowadays that too many alcoholics, when they come into AA, have exhausted every resource. So even though I have over 14 and a half years of sobriety, I still don't think of my sobriety as nearly as effective as that of men and women who are coming in now who still have their homes, their jobs, friends, but who are alert and who have a stronger desire than I ever had to get their sobriety. It seems as if I was one of those individuals that had to lose every fixed loyalty to reach a point of having a desire to really want to quit drinking, and a desire that meant something. Now, all of us, regardless of how much education or training or anything like that, about all we have to offer as authority, any speaker or you or anyone else, is our own personal experience. If you take that away from us, we just don't have anything. And therefore, I'm glad that in our preamble we have it clearly stated that no one is an authority, that you don't pay too much attention to what anyone says except the statements that might be reconciled with our book. And so I would like to leave then the first statement in the book as the basis of this little talk of Behind the Bottle. And that is, when I came in to AA here in Dallas, there were about 12. Now, you had a bigger meeting, I think, at your last discussion group last Wednesday. I understand you had 17. So you see, you were considerably larger than the whole Dallas AA group was back there. But when I came in, there was a great deal of attention paid to a new person, because myself and one other fellow who didn't make the program were the first two who had been in, come to AA in 3 months. In other words, the stigma, the shame attached to it and everything else was pretty heavy. And people were not responding to just a little news they knew about AA, and most of it misinformation. So, since it was 3 months since a new man had come in, why, naturally, you got a great deal of attention. The 12 AAs all came to see me within a period of about 36 hours, all of them. They were very enthusiastic about seeing you had something to eat. Because back in those days, a person just didn't have any money. And you remember how they used to say that if a man had a wristwatch back in those days, he certainly wasn't an alcoholic. And if one was so brazen as to say he had a set of golf clubs, why, wasn't even called a social drinker. He wasn't even eligible for that. And certainly, if he still had his family, they were very, very skeptical that anyone could stay with an alcoholic that way too long. So nowadays, it's so good to see so many men and women come into AA before they have lost all of the fine things that was their heritage. But I remember that the second night in AA, and I was staying in Charlie's home, and I was one of those persons who'd reached the point in alcoholism where you were just stupid. You couldn't think at all. You couldn't know how to use the telephone anymore. You were confused at everything. You could hardly find yourself a way around. And for a long time, I thought my mind was completely gone. And it took me a long time to get to thinking anywhere near straight. I think so many times alcoholics worry about that, but we shouldn't. I'm sure there's no one in here that could be called really a chronic alcoholic, because the chronic alcoholics once had definite impairment mentally and physically due to excessive drinking. That means impairment or disabled that there's no treatment known. And we know there's only about 10% of the alcoholics that have ever had what you'd call a mental impairment. And I think for no other reason than the facts about it, we should be very, very grateful that we found AA at the time we did. Some of us might have gone just a short time further on drinking and damage would have occurred that would have made AA impossible for us. Now, the only other person that AA can't help besides those that are definitely impaired is the person who cannot be honest about his life. He may say it with words that he wants to be, but he can't face up to true honesty. And our book says that the only one that AA can't help is this person who's constitutionally dishonest. And I've had two pretty close friends who came into AA who were that way. And it always worried me a great deal that they could be so sincere and try so hard and yet incapable of being honest. In other words, this factor of honesty is quite a big obstacle for the alcoholic, because our lives were dishonest. Our thoughts were dishonest as well as our acts. So the second night, Charlie was reading the book to me because I couldn't grasp the AA book. Oh, I'd been principal of a high school. I'd had a good education out in El Paso and things of that nature. And I've had in the education work all my life. But I was a victim of this illness, alcoholism, which, if it stays with you long enough, will disrupt your whole life. Someone said, why didn't you use your willpower? I said, do you realize your willpower gets sick too? Everything is ill. Your emotional and spiritual life, your body is starving for the things it has to have in the way of minerals and vitamins and so forth. And the fact that the alcoholic, like we are here today, just the fact we're here proves that we must have had a pretty strong constitution or we wouldn't even be alive. And the other reason it's a miracle to be alive is the fact that we exposed ourselves to so much grief and trouble, even death itself, and that we are still alive. I don't know of anything that would make me want to feel close to God more and more grateful than the fact that we have lived through so many things and still exist. And I think one of our founders, Dr. Bob, surely was right when he said, I consider it a privilege, a duty, a responsibility to attend AA and do all I can. And he did up until his death. In other words, we just can't throw this thing off and say, I'm gotten sober and that's all there is to it. So when he read in the book this statement, it threw the switch for me. It saved my life. Because it was the first time that I had ever realized what this alcoholism was. Doctors had never used the word, some 54 of them, and I'd been 11 and a half months in hospitals. And I had never heard anyone say the alcoholic is sick or he can be helped or is worth helping. That was a strange statement that I didn't hear till after I came into AA. But in our book is this statement. Our bottles are only symbols. Our drinking is only a symptom. And we must quit fighting anybody or anything. Now, the only way to quit fighting anybody or anything is to surrender. And as Dr. Thibault said, when one alcoholic makes a wholehearted surrender without reservations, he doesn't have trouble. But many, many times, unless we've taken our fifth step, unless we've lived this program like we should, we have reservations we are in ourselves not conscious of. And only in the fifth step do we find a way. In our conversation with somebody else, do we reveal maybe some of our resentments that we would never know we had unless we were talking to someone else about the problems that worry us. So I hope you'll never skip that fifth step. I hope you won't consider it an event at all to take once, but a constant source of strength to us when we become irritable or upset that we have on tap somebody who is a good listener, who can let us kind of let off steam and so guide us back into the right points on this program. So when I found out that this drinking with the alcoholic was a symptom and that his problem was not alcohol, his main problem, then that threw the whole switch for me. Had that statement not have been read to me, I was fixing to leave that man's house that night. I told Charlie, I said, "Charlie, I'm tired of all this thing. I'd only been in a few days, but I wanted to drink. I'm tired of hearing about it." He said, "Ars, would you do one thing for me?" And his wife had fixed a meal for me. Betty was kind and good. And back of Evergrade is a good woman like that, and the wives who stayed with him, we owe them everything. So here was a man who was begging me to give him 5 more minutes. And when I sat down there, that next statement was what he read. And I shall always be grateful that in his heart was a desire to help. He was enthusiastic about this program. And you can't help a sick alcoholic unless you're enthusiastic about it. And I don't believe you can be enthusiastic about this program unless you're living it. Unless you're practicing these principles and can see its value, I don't believe you can be enthusiastic. But did you ever wonder maybe why someone didn't listen too carefully to you? Do you know you can't sell AA like you do a piece of merchandise? The only way you can get a man who's sick to want to do something about his problem is to be enthusiastic. And enthusiasm, you just can't read it. You can't just hear somebody and then say, "I've got it." For instance, a man I heard told me once a long time ago, "I wish I had your brand of AA." I said, "If you did, you wouldn't have anything." Every person has to have his own brand. He has to have his own conception of this thing. He has to have an honesty about him. He can't take anybody else. Nobody's authority. I don't have any more answers than you do. But I know we have to keep a conscious contact with our source of strength. And I know what'll cause me to lose my conscious contact. And I think as we take our inventory, we'll know that. Now, behind the bottle, then, is alcoholism. I was a good candidate for alcoholism. I used to use a little illustration about ethyl alcohol was a register in the College of Alcohol Addiction. And when I went up to her desk, I had all of the requirements for a good entrance. I had more than necessary credit. Now I see all of that. And I know I had a hard time getting a divorce from Ethel. Oh, I'd take temporary separations and all of that. But I couldn't quite make up my mind. Now the reason I couldn't was because alcohol served a purpose to my life. It did something for me. Something that I needed to have done. Alcohol was a medicine to me. Of course, I know now that I'm allergic to alcohol. I know now that the body chemistry of the alcoholic won't let him drink controlled. And I know also that that's not a weakness. Because a person is allergic to alcohol doesn't mean he's a weak person. Usually the alcoholic is about as stubborn and strong-willed as you can find a person. But all of our stubbornness and strong-willedness is directed in a path that's usually not constructive. But when we about-face, we can use those things. Now, I'm very, very conscious of the fact that I was emotionally immature. And I was reading a story about an old boy. He looked on his hospital chart once and he saw that word, "This man, Mr. So-and-so, is emotionally immature." And he said he got so mad, he got his clothes and quit that hospital and got drunk for 6 weeks. It finally dawned on him what being emotional immature was. He thought it was an insult. Well, a lot of people are emotionally immature. What is being emotionally immature? Well, it's being sort of childish. Now, we have a little 9-year-old daughter. And I have a good chance to see myself in her. Why, an emotionally immature person, he hadn't grown up emotionally, but he's what an alcoholic, somebody described the alcoholics as an emotional scoundrel. Well, I realize I was. In other words, selfishness. He has no room in his self for anyone else. He wants to run the show. He wants to be on the stage. He wants to be the star. He wants to have charge of the lighting. He wants to tell the stagehands when to raise the curtain. He wants to tell them how many encores. And as soon as he's done his job, he wants to run out in the audience and do the cheering. I know what it means to want attention. And to want it so badly that if I couldn't get it one way, then I could throw a tantrum and make everybody miserable. Did you know a little child is, if they're very sad, it makes them quite upset if everybody around them is happy. They like to have a little sadness to join them. If a little child is very happy and the parents are very sad around them, watch it, they're quite miserable because they want their happiness to be shared. Did you ever see an alcoholic in his cups, how he did like to have the joy shared, and how he would get so upset if somebody didn't enjoy his enjoyment? Sure. This growing up is painful. And I don't know but one way to grow up. And that first thing that we have to do in order to grow up is to get some management in our lives and to end this civil war between what I am and what I'd like to be. And in order to end this war, I've got to have an armistice. In order to have an armistice, there's got to be some surrendering somewhere. Because if I don't enter in my inner conflicts, I'm not going to have room in my heart at all to love anybody. And our book says we have to love each other. We can't like each other, everybody, but we have to learn to love each other. So I had the personality requirements. I did some things under the influence of alcohol that I'm sure I would have never had the nerve to do otherwise. One thing stands out in my life that I, in the latter part of this principalship of this high school, when I was drinking so much every night, it was during the time that was letting so much money out, PWA and all this thing, spending for construction. And I know while drinking one night at that high school, my office, I looked out there and I said, well, why can't I go to Washington and get the money to build a big stadium out here? And I went to the president of the school board and the superintendent and said, you have no more chance to do that than to catch a whale out of the Rio Grande River. Everybody discouraged you. They said it can't be done. Well, I said, I believe it can be done. So what do I do? Well, I get me 3 or 4 quarts of liquor and I get on the train and I go to Washington, D.C. Now, I go in there and I plead before the RFC. I tell them we have a big high school, but we have no playground, no stadium. And I said, El Paso is an international town in many ways. I said, we're bordering Mexico, supposed to be a friendly nation. We have little Mexican children there as well as Anglo-Americans. I said, if you'd go out there at the end of a day and see how their little knees were skinned, and how much time the nurses were spending in bandaging their bruises as they fell over those old rocky and graveled vacant lots in their eagerness to become good Americans and in their desire to serve. They had nothing. And then I'd slip off the restroom, take another swig, and I'd come back again. I got over $200,000, the biggest grant ever given to a little high school, for the purpose of building a stadium. I'm certainly sure that I could not have done it without alcohol. Then, as time progressed, I'd get morbid. One of the tragedies in my life, I never have been able to correct it. I say tragedy, it may not have been, but it bothered me. I was up there, when I'd get to drinking, I wanted to become a captain of the sea. I loved to sail the ocean blue. And I'd hire a taxi and go clear up to Elephant Butte Dam from El Paso, a long ways, cost a lot of money. And I'd rent a great big old cruiser they had up there. It'd seat about 50 or 75 people. Then I'd get up there and get my cap on, and I'd sail around this big old Elephant Butte, this big old dam. And there's the way I'd live in another world. One day I found an old ranchman somewhere from West Texas. Wished I knew who he was. He was sitting there kind of sad. You've seen the time when alcohol made you cry, because alcohol releases what's inside of you. It doesn't put anything new there. There's always that. If you have a capacity to do something and alcohol releases it, it means it could be released some other way. It's there. So then I picked him up and I took him out of boat riding. And I was a little bit emotional, too, at that particular time. And he told me one of his great longings all of his life was to have finished high school, never graduate. So I said, well, I can very easily correct that. I said, I've got a permanent high school certificate, and I've taught a good deal. I used to be in a high school anyway. Now, if you want to, we'll have the baccalaureate and the commencement, and I'll write you out a high school diploma. And we did. I preached the baccalaureate. I gave the commencement address, and I took off my ring that I graduated from SMU back in 24, gave it to him with his diploma, and then we sang Auld Lang Syne. It was one of the beautiful occasions in my life. And this man was so happy that he now was a high school graduate. I never have found my ring. If you ever see out in West Texas some old Rushman wearing an SMU ring, I wish you'd tell him wished I could get it back. Now, those are little incidences that show you how we, as individuals, react so differently to alcohol than anybody in the world. It changes our personalities completely. Now, I did some things that were very crazy, and for that reason, I haven't had any trouble at all with that step where it says restore us to sanity of thinking. If I was sane back there, I don't want to be sane, if that was sanity. I realize there's three kinds of people. There's the unsane, the sane, and the insane. Some people are neither one or the other. As old Dr. Jellick said, some people are born half drunk and it only takes a little alcohol to make them full drunk. And I wouldn't doubt but what I was one of those. Now, what I'm getting at merely is this, that I found a way to overcome your timidity and your shyness without losing your self-respect. In other words, I'd get drunk, things would happen bad, you'd have the remorse and the regrets and the sorrow of it. But now, I've been able to meet my fellow man on a level without having to take an artificial substance. Now I know that AA, if an alcoholic just come into AA to get sober, for God's sakes, what's the use of it? To come in, to get dried out, and never remove the need for alcohol, and then just fight it all the time. That's not AA. AA only has the word alcohol once time in it. It knows that our drinking's a symptom. It knows our real problem is a personality problem. That alcoholism is a character defect. That we have to change our attitude toward life. We have to learn to give of ourselves. We have to change so many things. Our lives were unmanageable. But this program has the answer. I think it has it for anyone with an emotional problem, whether they be alcoholics or not. I think it's a badge of normality to live the AA program, whoever it might be. It's not something for abnormal thinking. It's normality at its best, to be willing to be in partnership with a power greater than yourself. It's like that old two women were talking. Her husband was drunk and was acting awful ugly, and she said, "You think he's mean when he's drinking, you ought to see him when he's sober." You do see a mean one. No, you might not be throwing things and cussing and all of that. But there he is, scared. She's scared all the time. He's unhappy. That's not what AA gives us, that kind of way. We don't want that sort of a sobriety. What we want is a sobriety that will take the brakes off of our own talents, that will take the brakes off of the God-given things that we have in our lives and let them function in the management of our lives, wherein we are rearranged. We use the same timber. We can't throw away whatever the construction material was. In your case, it might brick or lumber or whatever it was. But it does mean that we get a new blueprint. And from an old dilapidated building, we can buy a blueprint, take that same material, and reconstruct our lives. The greatest joy that I have in AA is practicing the principles in everyday affairs. It's the most rewarding thing in the world to be able to live on a level of inspiration rather than logic and facts. Our program says the AA has to live on a level of inspiration and intuition, that he must be that close to his God He follows spiritual hunches. He does not have to depend on cold logic to do things. He gets up in the morning and gets his life straightened out before he makes a contract. He wouldn't make a morning contract with God with his life full of resentments. That's no contract. He has to clear out his old warehouse and then say, God, help me to live this 24 hours in such a way. There'll be no need for anything done in my life in the way of alcohol. Same way with any other problem, where it'd be goofballs or anything else. Because I was on those things awfully bad with the alcoholism. And I know that there's no addiction that man faces that won't respond to this AA program if he's willing to be wholehearted and honest in his relationship with himself and his God. I'm so strong for it that I just absolutely believe in my heart that if every alcoholic and every AA could really use this program to the extent that it's capable of being used, there's just no problem you have that can't be brought about for an effective solution. It works is the greatest thing you can say about AA. But I'm not foolish enough to believe that AA is the only thing for the alcoholic. There may be some people that need something else. Our book says often the alcoholic may need some help from doctors and psychiatrists. But I'm not going to ever make an opinion anymore about whether a man can make a program or not make it. I don't believe that's right. Now, in closing, I would like to make this little statement or illustration. That in our book, there's two stories in the old book. One is the man who nearly had to return to drinking because he let his love of the material things exceed his love of his fellow man. And when he did, he became so irritable and almost started drinking again. The other story has to deal with a man who analyzed the program every way he could, tried every way in the world to figure out why he was a different type of alcoholic than anybody else, why something other wouldn't work besides AA. So he analyzed himself into a state of confusion. Now, this man finally came to the conclusion that the open mind and willingness to try, if you do that, things would open up as you went along. He is the person in the artist story in our old book which said, let us never take the mystery out of AA. That the fine things that often work so beautifully, that let's not kill that by trying to see why, how, and where. Or as this psychiatrist in Denver said, he was an alcoholic. He came into AA, then he studied medicine, entered psychiatry. And as AA gets older, we find more and more people like that. Now, this man said, why spend a lot of time trying to find out the why about yourself and so forth, when in the end, if you're going to live a full, rich, contented, satisfying, sober life, you're going to have to take AA anyway. Why spend your time analyzing when you can spend all this emotional energy being a better AA? It made sense. So this man said, don't take the mystery out of AA. It'd be surprised if your motive is good, never worry about results. The theme song of AA is this: in the effort of the day is the gold of the day. If we have to have ad-machine results to have had a successful day, we're off the program. We don't accomplish those things that way. We make an honest effort to practice these principles: kindness, justice, honesty, and a feeling that we're in joint partnership with our God, and that we will keep our lives clear. And in that vacuum, instead of alcohol, we'll put this fine substance, the AA program, and it will bring about those things, I'm sure, that will lead for great satisfaction. Certainly it has for me. I think it's a wonderful way to live, and I hope we'll all continue to try. Because when you hear anyone say they're living to the best of their ability this program, the chances are they're just exaggerating a little, because I don't think any of us have ever given AA the full sway it has a right to deserve in our lives. At least we can leave you on your third anniversary hoping that you enter this new period of time with the feeling, I'm going to give it everything I've got, honestly, and see what happens. Thank you. I suppose that when your chairman was arranging the speakers for today, he did it in true alcoholic fashion by going to the two mental extremes. The gentleman whom you just heard with his inspirational talk on AA, who has lived it, is an erudite and learned man, we all know, and most of my education came from listening to people in neon-lit ballrooms, or barrooms, as the case may be. And it is very touching and makes me feel very humble to stand before any group of alcoholics at an anniversary meeting. These things, we could call them milestones instead of millstones. And AA being the first thing that I ever actually felt a great part of, or the only thing that I have ever felt an actual part of, I know you must feel the same way too. And I personally would like to, if compliment is the word to use, compliment you on your third anniversary. Horace talked about behind the Bible. And it's not very far from behind it to in it. And possibly I could say a few things about being in it and crawling out. And I think that all of our stories, as he so aptly put it, are the only things we have. How we suffered and what we did and how we rose above it. Our big book tells us that. And I think that having one of a psychiatrist on the West Coast to tell my wife that I was a helpless, incurable alcoholic and that there was nothing further that they had to offer me in this particular hospital, to having been condemned by a misunderstanding society like that, to have come to a place of peacefulness and contentedness today without having to take a drink, I think, within myself is an accomplishment. My wife and I are avid theater goers in our hometown. We have quite a large project there, and at one time or another, we have taken part, we've done a number of shows down there, but the thing that makes me feel so good, those of you who have ever seen the show, The Desk Set, maybe you've seen it on TV, well remember that it's a little bit lewd and risque. The director of the show, knowing that I'm an alcoholic, suggested that I play the part of this drunk who in one scene the curtain arises and finds him laying on the floor with a bottle in his hand, and from there to some more risque conversation. So on the night that I tried out for this particular part, I thought that I did an excellent job of it. And after it was over with, he said, "Joe, I guess you are typed, but this ain't it, because I can never imagine you as being drunk." Me, the guy that had been drunk for some 20 years, for a person to assume that about me was one of the greatest compliments I could have gotten, and knowing that it didn't mean a thing to him to say it. So I didn't get the drunk part in the show, because he thought I didn't look like one. But I've suffered all the byproducts of the disease of alcoholism. Horace was talking about in the early days in AA when we came in that a man was supposed to have lost everything. And I, too, would like to say that it's a rare pleasure to see a guy coming in AA these days with his wife on his arm with a package of cigarettes, and that was a great thing for me. And to still be holding on to something, because I came in like Horace talked about. I suppose at one time or another you can hit the point of zero and then get below it. That's the way I was. I didn't have any wife, and I didn't have any material belongings at all. And there were two banking institutions in California that were very industriously trying to find my whereabouts so they could enter suit for this below zero status that I just mentioned. I didn't have any teeth. Incidentally, you don't need them if you're on wine. The hospital extracted my teeth in December 1949, and I didn't even start shopping for teeth until 6 months after I came into AA in 1950. There would have been excess baggage, would have cost money, and I would have lost them. And a wino don't need teeth because he's on a liquid diet anyway. And I didn't have any of these teeth. I had on a pair of pants and a shirt that I had broken into a house in Texarkana and stolen. And that was what I brought to AA with me. And the amazing thing to me, when I made my first AA meeting, and I have to pattern all the rest by it, is that they didn't question me about any of these things. My values changed with my first meeting. And these things that had meant so much to me and that I had used for an excuse for being drunk suddenly lost their importance. They didn't ask me who I owed or what I could do even. And that was one of the things that struck the blow to me. And I was well taken by Horace's description of immaturity. I think that that is the greatest comparison of all of us alcoholics. I would like to elucidate or elaborate a little further on that comparison between a child and an emotionally unstable alcoholic. A child runs at everything he does. An alcoholic runs at everything he does. When he starts something, a child, he's very enthusiastic about it. Don't last long, though. It's all over and something new must be started. So is a child. Child can't stand frustration. Neither can an alcoholic. You take the bottle away from the baby, he cries. So does an alcoholic. And a child does some very untidy things in bed, and so does an alcoholic. I was guilty of those things, too. But I was strictly immature until I found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you want to be further enlightened upon how immature I was, just catch my wife after this meeting, and she can enumerate many of the things that I did that were purely childish. And whether that be sane, unsane, or insane, I don't want to have to go back to it. And that is the beautiful feeling of security that we come to in Alcoholics Anonymous. We know that by observation of those who have gone ahead, that we don't have to, today anyway. In the first page of our book, The 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions, there is a short paragraph that goes like this. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, when practiced as a way of life, will expel the compulsion to drink. That's keeping it, to me, very, very simple. I had the compulsion to drink, and when I finally was beaten into a position to come into AA, I wanted to expel that compulsion. And they told me that. Now, I wouldn't advise any of you people who are newer in AA to go out in your enthusiasm and try to explain alcoholic compulsion to a non-alcoholic. You'll be spinning your wheels. About the time that you become warm to your subject and tell somebody about drinking against your own will, they'll say, what you want to drink for in the first place? So I have found through bitter experiences and trying to convince my mother and various other people whom I thought a lot of and wanted to understand AA about the compulsion to drink, and I have yet to be successful with any of them. So within myself, I have to be happy in knowing that I have today expelled my compulsion to drink. I was highly amused at Horace's telling about securing this $200,000 for the stadium. I want to know if it's named after him. At least an alcoholic could have had that done, the Fort Stadium. And I thought of the many phony things, and we are so phony. I was working for the railroad in California. Most of you have seen the advertisements of the city of San Francisco, which is a beautiful gold and aluminum train that runs from San Francisco to Chicago. In the last 13 months before they shipped me off to the railroad hospital, I was working that train under a very unusual and alcoholic circumstance. I caught at the job accidentally, and the conductor was an old man who was practically blind, and he was sweating out 2 years for his pension. And I was braking on the passenger extra board. I wouldn't get a regular job, had enough seniority too, but people didn't like me. And I didn't want to stay on the same crew too long. And you worked faster and you could lay off more on the extra board. But I caught this job, and the old man coming back, he said, "Would you help me with the tickets?" He's blind now, and some of those tickets are that long. And I snapped them up in a hurry, had no trouble, and he was amazed at the dexterity with which I gathered in the loot. So he said to me, he said, "I'll make you a proposition. If you bid this job in and just get the tickets, that's all you'll have to do. I'll do the brakeman's work. You'll get out on the ground in the cold. I'll do everything that's necessary if you'll just stay with me here and do this ticket work. I can't see." And I got to thinking about that. That was a paradise for a drunk. I could go into the lounge car where they had a barber shop and have the curtain pulled, and the boy would serve me drinks. And it was a very happy combination there. But one evening, I was walking through the train to show you how phony we can get. And two ladies, one of them caught my sleeve, and she said, "Mr. Conductor, there's a man in the seat ahead of us drinking. And we object to it very strenuously." They were very pious-looking women, and they had me on the spot. I could hardly stand up. As long as I kept moving, I was all right. I could synchronize myself with the train movement, but I had to say something to this fellow drinking for their benefit. And I looked up in the next seat, and here's a young soldier, about 22 years old, couldn't have been an alcoholic because the bottle was nearly full. And I talked to him like this. I said, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself. Out here in a public place, drinking that nasty stuff. What if your mother could see you now? You will come to no good end," I told him. "And if you're going to stay on this train, you'll have to let me keep that bottle until you get off." I got off in 10 miles, and he went on to Chicago, but without his bottle. We can't get as phony as we can possibly be. But you know, down through the years, these crutches that we depend upon, and I say that it's the sooner a drunk loses them, the better he is. This thing that we call money and our wife and so on, if he's alcoholically inclined, I think maybe he needs a shove. And the last 3 years of my drinking was somewhat of a landslide. And things got to where they were pretty tough. I well remember that we had moved in with my wife's sister. And I told my wife that nobody in this small town would know that I drank unless she didn't tell her sister and her sister told it to all the neighbors. That's the reason that everybody knew I drank. Of course, they could see me coming in all the time, but it made good conversation, makes it sound good. But I remember, and if any of you have ever experienced this, it was one afternoon late. I had been in the bar all the day and had been asleep downtown. So I'd slept as long as I possibly could, and I was just in one of those states where I couldn't sleep and I couldn't stay awake, and I was full of booze. And I came in and lay down on the bed in my sister-in-law's house. My wife cried all the time, or made to-do over my drinking, and she was always soliciting help in one form or another, trying to seek some way out for me. And I remember laying on this bed, hearing this conversation in the living room. I was supposed to have been knocked out all the time I was. They didn't have any reason to think I wouldn't be knocked out this time and that I wouldn't hear what they said. And my wife said to her sister, "What would you do if you lived with a man like him?" And I remember it very clearly. My sister-in-law didn't take a moment in reflection in giving her answer. She said, "I would poison the son of a bitch." Well, I was too poor to hire a food taster. I couldn't afford one. But let me tell you something. That put me on a very close diet of soup. And I watched everybody eat ahead of me there and felt so guilty, and I stayed away from home as much as I could. But those are the things that we run into. You've had them. And I think that sometimes that we put a great emphasis upon our physical suffering. And I don't think that we remember enough about the suffering that an alcoholic has through these humiliations and indignities that he brings down upon himself. I remember those things stronger than I do the physical pain. Now, I'll grant you that from 4 o'clock in the morning till 6 is a long time. To wait for a bar to open and to shake is a horror. And to have DTs is even further than that. But to be humiliated and not know why, and say to yourself, "Why do these things have to happen to me?" I made the hospital in San Francisco and was thrown out and stayed there in and out 3.5 months and was sent down to Texas and got down there, and my own mother had me locked up in jail in Tyler. And that had never happened to me before. Been gone from home for 18 years, and the prodigal son returns, and here's the treatment that they give him. They have him locked up in the local pokey. And as I was up in jail there, hating my own mother for having me locked up in this thing, I couldn't answer any of these questions. Why does this happen to me? And then after they found out that they couldn't do anything for me, they arranged to have the two deputy sheriffs load me in a police car in Tyler and take me to Houston, which is about 200 miles, and sit in the depot down there and wait for this train to leave. And all during the afternoon, I knew that every eye was on me. I have relived those hours in that Southern Pacific depot many times, and until I came into AA with bitter hatred. To have been subjected to such humiliation. It was summertime, and these two fellows were in their shirt sleeves, and they had pistols that looked like that long on them. And I was between them everywhere they went. And that evening, about 11 o'clock, they took me out and put me up in this train to send me back to California. See, California had sent me to Texas, and now Texas was sending me back to California. And I never will forget how humiliated I was when these fellows helped find me a seat. I could have found it all right, but they helped me. I'll say this, it's not a quick way to make friends on a train. They stayed away from me. But talking about humiliations and indignities, that doesn't have to happen to me today. I have never been humiliated since I come in AA. I remember very well talking to a group of youngsters in a church one Sunday evening and telling them of what little I know about alcoholism. And after it was over, they were asking me questions. And one little character in the back raised his hand, and I said yes. And he said, "Let me ask you something." He said, "Do these things that we ask you embarrass you?" And I said, "No, friend, that is an impossibility with me. You just don't embarrass me very easy." But down through the years, we talk about the progressiveness of alcoholism. Now, wouldn't it be nice if I could, being an alcoholic and having all these symptoms that Horace talked about, wouldn't it be nice if I could have only affected myself? But such is not the case. It seems that everyone we touch and those that we come in contact with, it just suddenly starts to decay. And I know how deeply that I hurt my wife, my mother, and how I galled various and sundry employers. I say this with the greatest of humility, as a matter of necessity. And being an alcoholic, I am now into my fourth profession. I drank out of three of them and could never go back successfully. And I've had to learn during my lifetime four different things to do to keep alive, actually. And all of it was caused by alcoholism. But I hurt my wife. She's always been very eager to do church work. And everything would be fine for a while until something happened. Nobody ever asked her to quit, but she began to suffer these humiliations and indignities. And that's, in looking back upon my own experiences, that's what makes me happy when I see a guy come into AA with his wife on his arm. That, to me, he's got 90% of a chance of making the program. We got a little guy down in Tyler, 23 years old. And if it's not the cutest thing you ever saw to see him come dragging that diaper bag over his shoulder and his wife going in with the auxiliary, and she's young enough to be a child. But his story, at his age, satisfies him that he is an alcoholic and he hasn't had any trouble since he's been among us. So I think that maybe when we get older in AA, we form a sort of a occult priesthood and become elevated, and we say, we get off and we say, "That one can't make it and this one can't make it." Horace mentioned that. And I've been guilty of that sort of thinking. And I'm so proud when a guy makes a liar out of me. And I've had it happen so many times. I got one guy that I've worked with down in Tyler down there. He's had his birthday last year. And he says that he wore me out as a sponsor and then went and got him another one. But about 5 years ago, one Sunday morning, he called, and Mary answered the phone, and I've always said she's a better 12-stepper than I am, but she said, "Yes, he'll be there pretty quick." And I went out to see this guy, and he can't hear very well. He uses a hearing aid. And the only way I could get him to an AA club was to knock him out. He was just fixing to go into DTs, I think, but I got him a good jolt of whiskey, and I think, personally, this is my own opinion, that any way you can get them there, the better it is. It suits me. The method justifies the cause. But he woke up sitting way back on the left side of this AA club, not knowing where he was. And I can honestly say this, if he didn't give me hell for the next 4 years, I never have had it. He had a disease that some of us had more of than others, and that's telephonitis. And the longer he could call, the better he liked it. And he'd get off, and I'd hear from him, "Collect New Mexico, collect here." And I always took him. So on his last drunk, he didn't call me. He said he was ashamed, too. But he called another fella and went out there, and they put him in the hospital. He had his birthday the other day. And I have sat mad at him and said, "He don't have a chance. I wish he'd leave me alone. That man can't make this program." And You would have to see him now to be able to appreciate the serenity. I've seen him in AA meetings as one of the most comical things that we talk about. You know, every club's got its little local gossip. Be sitting in the middle of a club during the meeting and his batteries go dead on this hearing thing. And he yanks them out and throws them on the floor. You can hear it all over town. Gets up and walks out. He's a very high-tempered fella. And this last year of sobriety has done me more good in the observation of his growth than anything I have ever experienced in AA. Those are the things that I think we're tremendously, and I'm not preaching. I came by a fellow's house this morning on the way up here who, materially speaking, falls in the millionaire class. We don't have too many millionaires in AA, but we have a few. We go up often and sit around his table and talk. And one of our ex-members who they're burying today in Mount Vernon, who got some sort of a mental disorder a few years ago and left us and has been drunk ever since, died this week. And this is the sort of a conversation this guy made, the statement he made to me this morning. He said, some of us fail. Which one of us was it when we let old Shine die? He said, here I sit in a comfortable home with the attitude that they should come and get it. And I feel as guilty as I can feel about it. Having had a spiritual experience, we tried to carry this message. And I have been as guilty as the next one in sitting and waiting for him to come get it. And thank God the guy that gave it to me didn't wait for me to come after it, because I was so mentally unadjusted, so unreceptive to any sort of thinking, that I would have never been here had he used that application on me. But he visited me in the jail in Tyler, and I turned him away with some of the roughest talk, I suppose, that an alcoholic has ever received in making a 12-step call. I deliberately tried to offend him and couldn't. And I told him that the thing that I wanted to know most was who sent him to see me. I wanted to know where to place this blame on my mother, my brother, or who, to have a man to come down and talk to me about alcohol. And I didn't have any problem. The only problem I had was that iron that was wrapped around me. And if he could help me get loose from that pokey, I would be forever indebted to him. But he came to see me. And my friends, further than that, some 5 months later, after wandering up and down the West Coast in a hell that is indescribable, he came to see me the second time. And lo, there is the secret of this program. The second trip. And when I hear a man say, oh, I tried to help him, he'll never make it, something happens in my stomach. Because he had ever occasion and ever reason to say that before he made the second trip. He could have satisfactorily justified himself in saying, I went to see him in jail. He ain't ready. He don't need it. I've got other things to do. But he closed up one of the busiest offices in that city, very responsible job, and came the second time, this thing that we talk about carrying the message to the other alcoholic. And that was the thing that was the convincer. A total stranger. It's true that we have nothing to do with the people who are close to us and want to help us the most. We abuse them the most. But here's a total stranger who, when he came to me, gave me what we commonly know as the AA pitch. He wouldn't talk about me. He talked about himself. That way I couldn't give him any answers. If he'd asked me about me, I was ready. But he told me about me. And then he used a phrase that has the greatest strength in our society that I think of any, and that is that we have found from our experience. That's the softest, most suggestive thing to a torn-up drunk of anything I know. If you do this, we have found from our experience, our whole program is based upon experiences. And he told me those things, and never one time pointed an accusing or a condemning finger at me. And he told me that thing, you're sick. And drinking is a result of these many things. And I can see it on you. You hate too strenuously. And you've got to quit hating before you can ever be sober. And then he hauled me to my first AA meeting and introduced me to what I can only describe as is a new way of life. That's all. Horace and I were talking before the meeting today, and we were talking about what a sudden shock it is for a person who has built up his whole system to continuously using alcohol. Every chromosome in his body cries out for it, and to suddenly extract that from him. That's asking lots of a drunk, you know, to take them. And I went through a lot of periods during the early days in my AA instruction, and I like to call it instruction, when I was a borderline case. And had it not been for the wise counsel and this thing that kept coming to me, we have found from our experience, you try it, I would have never made it. And then again, they started talking about God. Now, my friends, I don't know too much about the mechanics of God's handiwork. I would have to leave it to those who are more literate. But I established a faith like that which I had never had before.